Well, I'm Rachel, and just to give you guys just a little bit of background on me, I'm from Texas, born and raised there, other than 2 years when we lived in Tennessee, and then several months when I lived overseas in Zambia. So snow to me is this like rare phenomenon that happens once in a blue moon, and so getting to see it, I just kind of marvel at it because I see it very often. So I mainly work at my church. I work at the Village Church at a location in Plano, and I work as a groups minister. And so I mainly work with women. I help oversee our recovery and care ministry. And so this is just people coming into our church for different things. It's kind of a front door ministry where people may come in that aren't members or aren't attending the church. Maybe they're addicted to drugs, maybe they have anxiety, they're having difficulties in their marriage. And so I'll oversee and disciple our female leaders that lead out in those groups. And then we also have a discipleship ministry that's a lay biblical counseling program called STEPS. And so I'll help with some of the teaching and training that we do in that. A lot of the women that come in and I'll meet with, we call them care cases. And so typically they'll come in, usually there's something going on with the couple, there's some marital issues going on, just some difficulty at home, maybe they're struggling with depression, they're struggling with eating. And so I'll talk with them a lot, meet with them at the church. I also have a private practice outside of our church. And it's at North Texas Christian Counseling. And so I've worked there for several years. Worked for about, I think it's been about 7 years in a private practice setting. So I see women, teenagers, mostly abuse, those who've had abuse in their childhood. Although I'm seeing a lot of these anxious teenage girls right now that are struggling with their eating disorders. And so it just depends. It comes in waves. Prior to that, before I was involved in biblical counseling, I worked at a psychiatric hospital for a couple years and then worked with eating disorders at a center there for about 2 years. And so when I was working with eating disorders, I would see women that would come into our center, and they were typically given so many diagnostic labels. They may have been anorexic, they may have been bulimic, but then they also had depression, anxiety, maybe they were self-harming as well as their eating disorder, or they were trying to self-medicate by drinking. So there's just this host of problems. They were typically given what was like called a personality disorder, which in just the psychological, psychiatric world, those are the things that you don't necessarily want. I think it's just really a continuum of sin. If you look at it, the DSM, my belief, it's just this continuation of acting out the sin that's in our hearts. And so what I noticed, though, in each of these women were these commonalities of the fact that they either grew up in a home where there was extreme domestic violence and or they experienced childhood sexual abuse. And so the more we would kind of talk as their symptoms decreased when they were using their eating disorder to try to manage their emotions, then we could start to talk more about their trauma. And so it's just interesting what the Lord has shown. And so I kept thinking, this is so interesting. It's so much more complex than we see. And that's just kind of a little bit about me. And it's just a field that I've been interested in for a while. In fact, I was sharing with my mom at dinner. She came into town to just accompany me on the trip. And I was telling her about our case study. And I was like mentioning to her, and she just kind of like, she was like, the things that you're interested in, I'm grateful for. She was like, it's just very odd to me what you talk about constantly. And she was like, the things you read. And she was like, I'm grateful that there's people like you. But she would, she would testify that my heart has always been drawn to hurting individuals. Even when I was a little girl, she would talk about my compassion. And then I have, the Lord has just gifted me with this interest in overseas missions. And have spent a lot of time in Africa and some in the Middle East counseling women and doing some training in the areas of biblical counseling and in sexual assault. So these women just keep sitting in front of me. And God and just his sufficiency of the scriptures have taught me so much about what it looks like to suffer well. And these women have taught me so much about what does it look like to continue to persevere and have hope while you're struggling with suffering, with trauma. And so in Hebrews 13 and 12 and 14, it says, Jesus suffered outside the gates in order to sanctify the people through his own blood. Therefore, let us go to him outside the camp and bear the reproach he endured. For here we have no lasting city, but we seek a city that is to come. And so I think about this and thinking about outside of the camp, which usually were the lepers and the outcasts. Were. And so typically those who have struggled with this ongoing abuse when they were little, and then maybe they've sinned as in response, and promiscuity, drugs, addictions, things like that. These are things that most people don't like talking about, but the Lord in his kindness loves these individuals and loves those who've been oppressed, and he desires to come and set them free. And so I kind of see trauma as a mission field, and so that we're to follow him into this mission field of helping to set the captives free. And so Don Richardson, he was a missionary. He wrote Brusco. He lived in Papua New Guinea and then lived in Indonesia. He has this idea where he talks about redemptive analogies. And it basically illustrates the meaning of the gospel. And so he combines kind of the biblical representation of the incarnation of Christ. And so when we're looking at, and he's talking about culture groups, every culture and people group have this kind of hole, if you would say, in their culture where the gospel of Christ, right, fits in. It's based on Ecclesiastes 3:11, that he has set eternity in our hearts, yet we cannot understand it. And so that's how I see trauma fitting in as a mission field, that these individuals may have suffered oppression, extreme duress, and suffering, and that the Lord has specifically come to set them free. Now, that doesn't mean that they will never suffer again, but what does it look like to have him as our hope? And so Curtis defined trauma for us earlier, and so it also kind of just results, trauma results in this profound sense of vulnerability and kind of this loss of control. It just exceeds one's capacity to cope. Now, one of the interesting things is that a lot of people can go through similar circumstances, but maybe only 25 to 35% of the population may be diagnosed with what would be complex post-traumatic stress or post-traumatic stress. And so one of the reasons they found is that sometimes people process better when they have really good support systems, when they have kind of a better understanding of trauma, or I would call it like a theology of trauma and suffering prior to entering into that. But it is different when it has started in childhood, and that is just kind of the nature of how they see life. So it has happened that there are individuals that don't always respond with the same symptoms if they're in similar circumstances. So again, it's this different thing we're trying to figure out. Doesn't mean that there's a weakness of character if an individual does exhibit symptoms of trauma. It just means that they're just different. The Lord's wired them and knows every number of their days. And so I think in order to really counsel and minister to those who have been traumatized, it's helpful to really have a good theology of trauma, which is a good theology of suffering. And so if one's pre-trauma, pre-suffering beliefs are pretty strong, then their resiliency can be much higher. And so for us to have just a small understanding of evil and suffering in this world, one of the things that I'm grateful for is at my church, I really feel like my pastor has done a really great job of just kind of banging out what a theology of suffering looks like and really trusting in the sovereignty of God. I think about this, and I don't know if any of you guys have seen this movie. It's called Life is Beautiful. It won an Oscar, I don't know, probably like maybe 20 years ago. I think it was 1997. It may have been later than then. But it basically depicts this man who he and his wife and his son ended up in a concentration camp. And so in order to really kind of sensitize his son to where his son isn't experiencing all the duress, he tells him that they're in this game, and that You win so many points, like if you stay hidden from the soldiers, and if you don't complain and you don't cry, and that all these things that they're doing, it's a game, and you lose points, and basically the winner of the game gets a tank. And so the boy, in the end of the movie, grows up to be a man, and his father had passed away, but he said that his father's kind of view of seeing their life in a concentration camp as a game kind of helped change how he responded to it. So for us, when we're thinking about trauma, I want us to think about what if we were to read the Bible in such a way to build a theology of trauma and suffering for victims? Like, what would that look like? And especially it's important as us being the helper. And so I really wrestled with the Lord in this area the last probably 10 years. And this has been probably the most helpful thing in my faith, just wrestling with him on, okay, why did you allow these things to happen? And just the atrocities that occur. And it's been very encouraging to continue to go back to his word and to pray and just to be a learner with these individuals, learn what their experience was like, what their beliefs were, what their thoughts were. And just hear what the Bible has to say to them. And so for that, Diane Langberg, she's a psychologist. She's a biblical counselor. She wrote several books. One is I really enjoy is called Suffering in the Heart of God. She says that the cross is where trauma and God meet. So we think about Jesus crying out due to the pain of abandonment by the Father. And so we have this high priest that understands and empathizes, sympathizes with our weaknesses, yet he is without sin. So we can read the entire scripture, like Curtis was saying earlier, from when Adam and Eve sinned to finding Cain, right, to the cross, to we're living in this already, not yet, when we're waiting for the return of Christ. We can read the lens of scripture through the idea of trauma and suffering. And so Dr. Phil Monroe, he is a psychologist at Biblical Theological Seminary, and he talks about these key themes that are often in like this theology of trauma. And he said not just the foundation of God himself, but like the unjust torture and death of Christ. And so one of the things he mentions is that anguish really is the norm of our experience here on earth, and that it leads really most frequently to questions. So 40%, right, if we look at the Psalms, 40% of the Psalms are laments, right? This doesn't include the prophets, right, or lamentations. And so anguish, right, is an appropriate form of communicating to God and with one another, if you look at Job. But oftentimes, we're not as comfortable with hearing people's anguish. When we were at the board meeting this past week, one of the speakers, her name was Eliza, she was talking, she quoted John Piper and talked about this idea of wind words. Comes from Job 6:26, and how sometimes when people are in such grief, right, they say things out of despair that aren't necessarily true of their beliefs. Right? And are we able to allow at times people to speak what's going on without running right in and correcting theology right away? Like, are we able to do that and just sit with them and mourn with them? And so we see God expressing anguish as well. He was anguished over Israel's idolatry in Ezekiel 6:9. Jesus expresses his anguish in lamenting over Israel in Luke 13. Cries out in anguish and abandonment by the Father on the cross, right? And so I just want you to think about, like, how comfortable are you, like, with sitting with people who are broken, who are just lamenting and in anguish? Are you comfortable, or do you feel this desire to want to fix it and make it better? And are you okay with just mourning with them as the Lord has called us to? And so another one of these aspects in the theology of trauma is that peace happens in the context of chaos. Right? We see David reciting Psalms 23, and it comes to people where they're in trouble and expresses peace and rest during this intense time of trouble, right? Even though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, you are with me. No, your rod and your staff, they comfort me. So there's these shadows of death, yet there's comfort. And so there's enemies that are surrounding them as they're feasting. And so peace happens, but rarely does it happen outside of chaos and distress. And so even looking at the story of Mark 4, when Jesus is on the boat and they're going across the sea and the winds and the waves, right, they're washing over the boat. And you see the disciples before they leave, right, and kind of their picture of peace is right in the fact that the circumstances are great. Jesus had told them what they were going to do, and he had made a promise they were going to the other side. But then they start just freaking out. Oh my gosh, we're dying. Why don't you care about us? And you see Jesus, and he is the portrait of peace. He's sleeping. He shows us his vulnerability and humanity, that he so trusted in the Lord and where they were going, that even though this was a very fearful situation, he knew where they were going. And so we see that he represents that to us. This was important for us to, that would be great. I have something in my throat. So it's important for us to continue to remember that as we sit with those people, thank you, who have been traumatized. And so also the kingdom of God in the present doesn't promise the protection of our bodies. And so if you think about this, this is a common question, and Curtis mentioned this, right? And just the man's talking about God kind of promising this good life. When you read through some of the Psalms, whether it's Psalm 121 or even the other day I was looking at Psalm 4, and in verse 8 it says, "In peace I will both lie down and sleep, for you alone, O Lord, make me dwell in safety." Let me get some water. So if you think about reading this with a woman who's been molested repeatedly at night by an older brother or stepfather, think about some of the questions she has as she reads this. I wasn't protected. I didn't lay up. I was in fear. I couldn't sleep. Where was God? What does this promise apply to me? Does this mean that this isn't true of me? And so our theology of God's care really has to take into consideration that he doesn't eliminate disaster on the people he loves. Elizabeth Elliot, who, she's one of my heroes. Her husband was Jim Elliot, missionary, passed away. Anyway, she says that our vision is so limited, we can hardly imagine a love that does not show itself in protection from suffering. The love of God is of a different nature altogether. It does not hate tragedy. It never denies reality. It stands in the very teeth of suffering. The love of God did not protect his own son. The cross was the proof of God's love, that he gave that son, that he let him go to Calvary's cross, though legions of angels may have rescued him. He will not necessarily protect us, not from anything it takes to make us like his son. A lot of hammering and chiseling and purifying by fire will have to go into the process. Now, is it really helpful to start out first thing with that, with a woman and say that? No. But as a helper and as a minister, I think it's important for you guys to have that aspect in your mind, right? So that later these questions are going to come around and gently pointing them to that. And also just looking at the disciples, right? It didn't end well for them. It did, but not physically, right? And Jesus even tells them, hey, don't fear people who can kill the body. Right, and he's talking about the appropriate one to fear. And so another aspect or a theme kind of in this theology of trauma is that God and his people, so his church, right, we're in the business of trauma prevention, justice, and mercy responses. And so until the Lord returns, right, there will be evil and suffering in this world, right? There will be poor among us. But as believers, we are called to push back the darkness, to continue to rescue those. And so the Lord speaks about his care for those who are oppressed very often, right? So we look at the lengths that he went to deliver the Israelites out of Egypt. And Jesus himself is a fulfillment of healing, right? He claims this in Isaiah 61 in the beginning of his ministry. And so we are his people, and we're his hands and feet. And so we're to continue to help him to bind up the wounds of those who are oppressed and to continue this mission. And so, and then just kind of two more aspects of this is recovery and renewal during and after trauma likely will not eliminate the consequences of violence until the final return of Christ. And so despite our call to heal the broken and free those people who are enslaved, we're given no promise, right, that the consequences of violence are fully removed until the Lord's return. So you don't expect somebody to kind of grow back lost limbs. or traumatic brain injuries to be erased from an accident. So when you're ministering to someone who may have what they would call triggers, right, these avoidance responses to situations, right, maybe it's a dark hallway, maybe it's a certain smell, maybe their startled responses or their flashbacks, they may not evaporate even in the recovery. Now, what we want to learn how to do is show them that these things are temptations, and so how to continue to go to the Lord in those things so that they're not sinning out of response, right? And so we talk about that a little bit later about like intentionally avoiding people and isolating themselves, right? I had a story of a young woman. And she had gone, she'd been molested, she'd been sexually assaulted, she's had this horrific history of trauma, and then she works in our children's ministry, she's great with kids, and they had done a training, Love and Norris, and it was basically teaching, you know, what to look for people who are predators, and so that they're not involved in children's ministry, or what to notice when kids are sexually abused, and we had talked prior to her going to the training, and I was like, hey, you're probably going to hear some things, and it's going to be really difficult. And she was able to talk, and I encouraged her, hey, make sure you go and talk to there's a children's minister who knows her story. And she did, and then she had told me, she was like, I felt really anxious, and I really wanted to be alone, but I went to dinner with a group of friends afterwards, and I was like, great. And then she was even telling me she was where she had been sexually assaulted had been at an apartment complex where there was a light that was flickering, and that was out. And then she said, wouldn't you know it, too, when I go home, she's in a new complex, and she said, I was walking up the stairs, and she said the light was flickering and was out. And I said, well, what did you do? And she was like, well, I prayed, and then I went into my apartment and locked the door, right? So I was like, this is so great. And then I was like, this is wonderful. She didn't self-harm. She didn't drink. And those were some things that she would have done in the past. And she said, no, but, and she was telling me, she was like, but I felt so anxious. And she goes, and I had those thoughts. And I said, yeah, I mean, sometimes that just doesn't go away, right? But look at what the Lord's done in your life. Like, you're not responding to your in your anxiety. You're trusting Him in the midst of your anxiety. You may be feeling panic and fear, just a bodily response. But instead of, like, going to self-harm and cutting, right, she's praying. Now, again, this process took probably about 5 years, so I don't want to, you know, allude you to thinking that it's a lot shorter than it was. So, and finally, just kind of the last thing that I want to look at on the theology of trauma is it really recognizes that we have this theology of presence, right? And so God is with us, and He will strengthen us and guide us to serve Him and participate in His mission unto His glory. And that's really important for them to know. Brad Hambrick, he is a pastor at the Summit Church in North Carolina, and he mentioned how quickly we often go to, like, the imperatives of Scripture. Like, you need to do, you need to put off, you need to put on, you need to renew, you need to remind. If you're anything like me, and I'm a little bit of a doer, like, you think of all the things and all the commands you have to do. And it's really important in this aspect of theology of the presence and character and nature of God. Hey, who is He? What has He done, right? And to really look at resting in those attributes. And especially if you have somebody who has experienced a lot of trauma, they're highly anxious, and highly anxious people do not want to rest. I at times struggle with anxiety, and I'm like, rest is not fun. I would rather go do things. But that is that's what He's saying, is, hey, be still and know that I'm God. And so knowing that the Lord is with them, right, is really important. And even looking at in Isaiah 53, how the Lord is described, right, He is a man of sorrow. He's acquainted with grief, right? He's been rejected and despised. So individuals that have been abused over a long period of time or have been in domestic violence situations, they can identify with Him, and He is present there in their suffering. But it's going to take a while to get there. And so it's really important for us to know those aspects as we're going in to sit with people, to love them, to counsel them, to listen to them, to really try to learn from them what it looks like, what their experience has been. So looking at complex trauma, so Curtis did a great job of explaining post-traumatic stress. Right. And so we're going to be talking about complex trauma. And so There's a statistic that those that have been abused in childhood are actually 8 times more likely to have a mental illness or an addiction. So maybe they are diagnosed with bipolar, major depression, they have an alcohol addiction. And so there are some similarities in post-traumatic stress and in complex trauma. And so I have told you I've seen this working with these women who had eating disorders. And so there was a psychiatrist, her name is Judith Herman. And so it was back in the late 80s, 90s, she started to recognize, and she had done some work with combat veterans, and she was also working with these victims of sexual abuse. And she was like, oh man, they display a lot of the same symptoms, right? Except maybe they're getting labeled with what's called borderline personality disorder, or they're hysterical. And so she was saying that, hey, there's a lot of similarities in post-traumatic stress and in what this population of abuse, right, is representing. And so she's noting that individuals who suffered severe, long-lasting trauma, especially early in life, right, they were suffering from some of these things that are similar, right? They had kind of a dysregulation of mood, right, kind of up and down. We'll talk more about this. They had impulse control. They had all these physical symptoms. They had dissociation. They had a hard time in self-perception. And so she was seeing that they were just displaying a lot of symptoms that were similar. They were very hypervigilant. And so she decided that, hey, it's really important to look at this as maybe pinpointed as another category of trauma. So now when Curtis was talking about the DSM, complex trauma has not been an official diagnosis. And so doctors are coding it as... I have to think about what it stands for. It's called DESNOS, which is Disorders of Extreme Stress Not Otherwise Specified. Mouthful. They're talking about it as developmental trauma, or they're labeling it as complex post-traumatic stress or complex traumatic stress, because sometimes the trauma is not post, it is continually ongoing. And so there are some overlaps between that. And so some of the overlaps that we mentioned, there's some flashbacks, night terrors, hypervigilance, dissociation, avoidance, right? So those are some of the things that are associated that post-traumatic stress and complex trauma share. One of the biggest differences, right, with complex post-traumatic stress is this condition that results from chronic or long-term exposure to emotional trauma over which one has little or no control and from which there is little or no hope of escape. So these are the cases of domestic violence, emotional, physical, sexual abuse as a child, concentration camp, and some prisoner of war. And so it often occurs repetitively, and it increases often over time. Like in concentration camps, the distress increases over time. And so in a family context, complex trauma, right, is ongoing, whether it's physical violence or sexual violence against family members. And so this type of trauma is interpersonal, right? It's not just marked by what we talked about. It's not just an event, right? And so it's harm from people who should have been their caregivers, right? Maybe that was a mom, a dad, a brother, an uncle, a stepfather, right? Or it's this ongoing event with their spouse, right? And so it's very interpersonal. And so what might this look like in your church? So 1 in 4 women have been sexually abused as children, and 1 in 6 men before they are age 18. Now, again, not all victims, right, of abuse are going to display effects of trauma. It really does depend on who they were abused by. And so in some of these cases, numbers for incest and ongoing incest are different. But in your congregation, if you think about this, 1 in 3 women have been physically abused by a partner. 4 out of 5 victims of partner violence are women. And so just for the sake of our time, complex trauma does happen to men. I've actually seen it and to the men at our church. But for just general speaking, I'll probably say she and females and women more. That's who I counsel and that's who I see as a female minister. But this does also affect men. So I don't want you to think that this is just females who have complex trauma. And so in Proverbs 24:11 through 12, it says that we are to rescue those who are being taken away to death. We're to hold back those who are stumbling to slaughter. If you say, behold, we did not know this, does not he who weighs the heart perceive it? Does not he who keeps watch over your soul know it? And will he not repay man according to his work? So I think it's important for us to remember is that there are people in your congregation who have been abused, who may be experiencing ongoing abuse, who may be having, they might have trauma. Maybe there's somebody who's the addict or somebody who's chronically losing jobs. They're not probably going to come up and tell you, hey, I'm struggling with post-traumatic stress or I have complex trauma. They actually don't know, right? They're just having really difficulty with day-to-day life issues, raising their kids, being in a relationship, right, and not going to these destructive things to cope. And so one of the things like I want you to think about is obviously we're not Christ, we are not the Christ. And so making sure that you know it's not your job, you can't save them. You can't fix them, but what we can do is continue to point them to the cross. We can continue to point them to where all of the hope is found. And really, I think one of the biggest things that I want to encourage you is, like, people that have struggled in this way, it takes a lot of time. And especially if they've been abused by a caregiver, their trust in humanity is not going to be that great. And so taking time, and the Bible again says, hey, we're actually not to trust man. We're not to put our trust in man. We are to trust the Lord with man. But one of the issues is obviously they don't trust God. They may say they do, but right, their life reflects something very different. Or I had a woman who told me, I trust him that I won't go to hell with my eternity. I just don't trust him to manage any of my pain and emotions and my relationships and all these things. And I was like, okay, well, this one is so much greater than these things. Things right here. And so it does take really time. And so the first marker that we're going to look at with complex trauma is, and Curtis mentioned this a little bit, is that it really does assault the self. Right, so there's this identity of the servant that occurs when they experience trauma, and it's, who am I? Like, do I matter? Am I lovable? Do I have any value? Now, as a little kid, they may not be thinking, do I have value? Do I have worth? Do I have significance? Right, they're probably thinking more, hey, my dad hurts me, and the problem isn't my dad. Kids are egocentric. The problem is me. I must be the problem. He tells me I'm bad. This is probably why I get abused. I'm bad. Right? There was a woman I was counseling, and we were doing a series at church probably 4 years ago on womanhood and manhood, biblical womanhood and manhood. And she had been repetitively sexually abused by her father for probably 10 years. And she told me, she said, you know, hearing Matt Chandler, my pastor, she said, hearing Matt say that I had more worth than a dog, she said, that's the first time I ever heard that. Mm-hmm. And you and I would think, or I would think, that's common sense. Of course you have more worth than an animal. Like, I love animals, but I'm not going to sacrifice my life for a dog. I don't have dogs, so, I mean, I may not get that and understand that. But now, if it was for my niece, absolutely I'd lay down my life for her. But she never experienced that. She said, well, our family pets were treated better than I was. I just thought that, you know, they were more important than me. And she wasn't. She was just staying there being very sincere. And we tend to think, well, how could someone think this? But this had been her experience, really, as a child. And a lot of times kids, right, their sense of self is really marked by what they see. They learn about abstract things concretely, right? And so love and trust from adults is really mirrored by what is seen. And so part of that really is biblical. Like, if we were to think about eternity, go look at the sea, right? If you think about infinity, you look up at the sky, right? Jesus is the exact imprint of God. So there's these ways that we are to know about what is unseen by looking at what is seen. And so children really, I mean, they are sinners. So we are not tabula rasa. I mean, I believe in human depravity, that we are marked sinners. And so they're very selfish and self-centered, but they don't cause abuse. But in their mind, they think that they do, right? And this is carried on into adulthood, right? So in their mistreatment, they don't say that their parents are bad. At the same time, right, in adults,
they take on this responsibility of this was my fault, I'm bad, but then you see in their life where they're not taking responsibility for other incidences or problems in relationships, right? They may be overly responsible in their views, but then they blame and shame other people, just, no, that's not my fault, no, I didn't do that, no, I didn't. And so it's this real kind of weird issue sometimes of what I've seen of like, hey, what is yours to own? You actually can't own being sinned against. You can own your response to that, which is that is what we can work on, you know, in and throughout, but you can't take that on. And so there really is a difference between being sinned against and responding to sin. And so I have a little video for you guys. I have a
BCTV. I think you're good. I just got to turn.
What's your AirPlay code?
It'll come up. Okay, awesome. Wait, how to do that? Turn it. There we go. It's a continual struggle. Is it working? Maybe. Get the remote control. There we go. Oh, there we go. Sweet. Okay.
So, okay, this is my, she's three at the time, this is my four-year-old niece. Now, I know her very well. She is definitely a sinner. She thinks about herself a lot. But just to have a good picture of even what a child thinks about of the Lord. So, I wanted you guys to have just kind of that picture, besides I think my niece is super cute, but I wanted you to have that picture to see that kids are pretty free when they're not obviously being abused, because they're also very egocentric. She has a glass, and she loves to look in the mirror, and she likes to be very girly. She likes to dress up and look at herself, and she thinks she's very pretty. But she really does believe what we have taught her, what her mom and dad have taught her, what I teach her, what her Nana and Pops teach her about Jesus, right? She goes to Sunday school. We read her about stories of God. We talk about the Lord a lot. And so she really believes that he loves her. She really believes he cares for her. She believes, right? She doesn't really understand that she's a sinner. At all. And so, but really kids learn about things when they're talked to them, right? And so imagine someone in your congregation that had grown up in church, right, whose father was abusing her and at the same time talking to her about the Lord. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of confusion that goes on there, right? I had one case where grandpa, who was a pastor, was sexually abusing my client, who was his granddaughter, and she was just really confused. She had this real special relationship with grandpa, but she was really confused at what he would talk about and who God was and how he would pray afterwards and tell her she was a sinner, and so she just felt horrible. And so when we think about that, or we think about trauma, really does attack three things. It definitely assaults the self, but it also assaults their view on God, which Curtis talks about, right? And it really does attack the view of others. And so God may not be this good, strong, safe, powerful person who loves them. And so one of the things, like one of the counsel that I'll do is really working on their identity in Christ. Really wanting to restore the image of God and man in them. And so oftentimes in trauma, God is kind of viewed from bottom up. Their experience is the lens in which they see him, right, versus top down. And we can kind of understand this, or at least I can. I mean, if you had a father who might have been a little bit distant or more critical, it really took some time for me personally to look through and see, hey, God, right, is not like my earthly father, right? And even the best dads are sinners. And so it is important for us to look at God through Scripture, right, through this top down instead of bottom up view. And so teaching them what that looks like. And that takes a lot of time because you really want to hear what has been their experience. experience of God? What's been their experience of other people? How do they view themselves? These things aren't going to change over time. And so, you know, if they're talking, you don't want to say, well, hey, you're wrong because God is sovereign, right? I mean, it's just lovingly pointing them to different passages. And so a lot of times we'll work on attributes of the Lord, right? We'll talk about maybe God being this unchangeable person or God being loving, right? But then where do they not believe that, right? And so some of those questions come up, well, how could he be loving, right? And then what aspects of his character, the immutable ones, the things that we can display, are they living out? And so I think that's important, right, even especially as we're looking at kind of their responsibility. And so the second thing with complex trauma is there's, Curtis talked a little bit about shame. So there's this deep abiding sense of shame that kind of feeds off of their identity of their self, right? And so bad things are reinforced to them often by blaming and shaming words. So if we look at the story of Tamar in the Bible, right after she has been sexually assaulted by her brother, by Amnon, he says, get that thing out of here, right? He throws her out of his bedroom. He calls her that. He actually doesn't even call her by his name, right? And so we see that, and that betrayal is really at their core. So I want you to think about that. Who also was betrayed? Right, so kind of have these things in your mind, and so they were hurt by those who should have been people that they could trust the Lord, right, to protect them. And so if you think about a child, right, that might be layered in blame and rejection and abandonment. And so you think about shame, and shame has this weird thing where it pays attention to shame, and so it might be the grid in which that they see things. And so they often think about themselves through this lens, right? I was told I was dirty. This happened to me, so I'm probably dirty. And so it's difficult at times when I've been counseling women, because I might say something or and we walk away from the conversation and it's like completely two different conversations. And this has happened enough times when I see their face start to change. I'm like, hey, what did you hear me say? Right? And they've got this other narrative, this other story going on in their head, right? And so maybe I say something about maybe in the response to their sin or something, or and they hear, oh man, I'm a horrible person, right? And this like script starts running through their head. I'm a monster. She thinks I'm a monster. Everybody thinks I'm a monster. I call it the shame spiral staircase, like where they just start going down the stairs. And so I think it's important, just when you're talking and listening to individuals, if you need them to clarify, hey, what, like, if you can tell, and it's actually even helpful in marriage conversations, like, hey, what did you hear me say? No, that's not what I said, you know. And so just asking for clarification, I think, is really important. And so even their words, because you might say a word and it means something completely different to them, right? So if I say I'm overwhelmed, right, it might mean, hey, I'm anxious and maybe I'm having a little difficulty sleeping and my brain is constantly going, right? That's going to look really different from a woman who says she's overwhelmed, that's experienced with chronic abuse. And so don't always think that your words and their words are the same. And so one of the things I try to do more often is just kind of ask them, hey, what do you mean when you say that you're depressed? What does that look like for you? When you say that you're anxious, what does that look like? Like, what does that experience like for you? What do you mean by that? Because I don't want to assume that I know what they're talking about, but I do know that Jesus knows what they're talking about, right? And so he has experienced that. I mean, the fact that he, in fear, shed blood, right, as he was sweating and praying in the garden. And so we really want to think about this in Genesis 3, right? So if somebody, you know, when sin entered in and they sinned against the Lord in disobedience, you see shame runs from God, shame hides from God, shame covers up, right? And shame often blames others. And so this is usually common in victims of complex trauma. You'll see this where they'll run from things, they'll run from God, right? They'll hide themselves. They can hide themselves in good things. They could maybe performance in grades. I mean, I've had girls, young women, right, who were like straight A students, overachievers, like they were doing all these good things because they were kind of hiding, covering themselves up and all these good things they could do, right? Okay, if I just look good on the outside, right, then maybe I'll feel better about all this nastiness that's on the inside. And so they're kind of covering up and oftentimes, again, blaming, not taking responsibility for things that they can, not for things that actually happened to them. So, and one way that I counsel, right, try to encourage them to walk back up the staircase, down the hallway towards, you know, who am I? How has God created you? you know, and really having them kind of imagine giving Jesus these words that were spoken over them, that were given to them if they were called a name or something, like handing him, you know, as we're praying these words. That were stated and things like that. And so, and another thing that have them do is really look for beauty, because a lot of times people who struggle with shame are very negative, they're very cynical, everything's bad, everything's horrible, they have this kind of fatalistic view of life. And so, right, and our God is the God of life and beauty and glory, and so I'll have them, like, hey, describe a flower that you saw to me today, like kind of like shifting things in their mind, or like, hey, tell me some things that maybe you've been grateful, really small little things that you've been grateful for. And just, you know, because that kind of mindset will start to trickle over as they're processing. And so part of this, and we'll talk a little bit more about it, is part of what is, like, I refer to as kind of like stabilizing someone, like helping them build on these, like, secular counseling would call coping skills. But the Lord tells us it's a command, right, to be thankful, to be grateful, right? And so we want to think about those things and start introducing those things, just small things as we're talking to them. It's not the very first thing that you want to do when you sit down with someone is, hey, list 5 reasons why you're grateful. But it can be detached from what actually happened to them. This third thing that is common in complex trauma is this distorted relationships, or really broken relationships. And so trauma really does, we talked about it, it affects, like, your view of others, so it affects how you relate to others. And if your view of the Lord and your relationship with God, right, that vertical relationship, it's always going to affect this horizontal relationship. And so it's really difficult. You can't bond if you've had parents that exploit you and abuse you, right? There may not be a safe person, right, in your life. And so people, right, are really developed and shaped, right, by kind of their sense of person. And so you want to think about this. And a lot of times, if you get kind of the history, they have, like, this history of broken relationships, just kind of dysfunctional relationships that they've had, this ongoing trauma and abuse. And so one of the things is that a lot of times it'll lead to re-victimization. I've heard this said before, I just don't understand why that woman doesn't leave him, right? Honestly, and maybe the husband is, like, violent, physically abusive. I don't get that. I don't understand that. What they may not know, and it's not always true, but it's often true, is that, I mean, her father was abusive, right? And so this is the kind of relationship that she's grown up with, that she knows. It's normal to her. And so often with this re-victimization, there's this inability to really trust, to not be vulnerable, and to be intimate. There's been this not a model for healthy intimacy. And so they can't make wise and good judgments. You and I would think, it's not helpful. And they're like, you know, I don't really feel like there's anything wrong with this. And so we would see warning signs, and Curtis talked a little bit about the brain, and I'll talk about it a little bit more, right? But when they're experiencing trauma, it's like if you're looking at the brain like this, and this is your brain, and so this right here, right, would be your prefrontal cortex. And so this right here would be your amygdala, or your limbic system, and this right here is your brainstem. And so your prefrontal cortex is the ability that you have to make decisions in your conscious and to think through things, right? Your amygdala is where you experience and process through emotions, and then your brainstem is this reactive fight or flight, right? And so when they've experienced trauma and they've been in this state of just hyper arousal constantly, right, this right here is like offline. And so this is what's making all the decisions. Like, this right here is where they're living, with all these emotions swarming around, and they're super overwhelmed. So you're talking about, hey, make these decisions of basically just leaving yourself or creating a safety plan. It takes a while, right, to get this back online. And then what's happening is there's just kind of, there's a lot of reactions going on. And so with these relationships, right, it's hard for them as an individual, like, to trust you as their minister, right? They don't trust you. Why should they believe you? They've been lied to before. They've been betrayed before. It's hard to feel safe. And so when I'm saying it's hard for them to really perceive, right, what is to come. And it's really difficult for them to identify body signals. So I can tell when I get anxious. When I get anxious, my stomach hurts, right? And then I notice my breathing slows down, right? And then my thoughts start to kind of roll one in over each other. They really don't have the ability to do that. They can't tell you if they're anxious or not. That might just be their state of normal, right? Mm-hmm. That's just kind of how they function. And so it's really difficult, right, for them to be able to identify breathing changes or the fact that their heart's racing or the fact, right, that they're really sweating badly. And so oftentimes, even in relationships, they might engage in like self-inflicted isolation and avoidance of intimate contact, right? So in some of post-traumatic stress, there may be avoidance of triggers. With complex trauma, often there's avoidance of relationships, right? Where it's like, hey, it's just safer if I'm not with people. And so they might be in that area, and then you'll also see them jump into these really unhealthy emotional relationships that they'll be in. I'm trying to hurry. I know we've only got like 15, 25 minutes?
Yes.
Okay. And so it alternates between being involved in these intense emotional relationships that are unsafe and then those that are out of control. Oftentimes you'll see those with complex trauma can victimize other people. And so it's the result often of being a target of victimizing others. And so other people are kind of drawn into this like woundedness. And somebody who struggled with trauma may have this, obviously we talked about this, underdeveloped capacity to like identify danger. And they have a high tolerance for like boundary violations where we would be like, hey, you can't talk to me like that or you can't push me. They're like, you know, that's kind of normal. And so they fear and really believe that they're not worthy of meaningful relationships. And so they have a really difficult time imagining a future without a relationship that's marked by abuse, right? Because like I said, those things are just normal. And so they also may be fearful to tell their story without being controlled by the perpetrator. One of the things you need to know, too, is are they safe? That's a good question to ask, right? So maybe they're talking to you about chronic sexual abuse. And so that might be different versus a woman who's talking to you about the ongoing domestic violence, right? So they did a study where they were trying to do trauma counseling on they weren't war veterans, they were active war soldiers. And it was horrendous because they're like, hey, we can't process the things that we've done while we're actively in combat, right? Because some of the way in which they had kind of learned to dissociate was actually helpful in what they were currently doing, right? Now, because it was ongoing. And so it's really difficult to talk about the trauma if they're living in this ongoing abusive relationship. So that's one of the things we need to make sure and establish is, hey, is there safety? Like, if there is domestic violence going on, man, what are the plans at your church to make sure that this woman is safe? Like, what are the plans at your church to make sure these kids are safe, right? So we want to make sure she's physically safe and that she's mentally safe, because a lot of what happens often in domestic violence relationships are there is suicidal preoccupation if one is either the victim or the offender, right? And so we want to make sure that they're safe both physically and mentally. And so they may be really fearful to tell the story. And so they see extreme fear as just this kind of childhood reaction that they can't get over. And so we want to be able to affirm that it was right to be fearful in them instead of shaming themselves for not being able to get over it. And so we want to make sure they know, hey, your fear was actually grounded in reality. And so another aspect is that they can often significantly bond with their perpetrator, especially if their perpetrator, the offender who's abusing them, is really grooming them, right? So it might be really difficult if dad was sexually abusing them or stepdad was sexually abusing them, but he also was the one that was, like, buying them bicycles and toys. And always there's this kind of, like, marked by this, like, special relationship of attention and adoration. It's really confusing where maybe they're getting told, hey, there's these great things, but at the same time, right, they're being abused. And so it's really difficult. And so people who struggle with chronic abuse and complex trauma, they often have this kind of black and white way of thinking. It's like all bad or all good. And then oftentimes we'll kind of say, well, the good outweigh the bad. And there's this aspect of like deception that's going on in their mind. I had one woman whose father was a pedophile. Now, he was not sexually abusing her, but it was her friends. And so, I mean, I remember her telling me, she told me, I mean, but my dad's a good guy. He's really nice and he always provided for us. And I was like, okay, there's that. But then there's also this, right? That's kind of, so you have to look at like, what ways are they lying to themselves? Are they deceiving themselves about kind of the reality that they're living in? And they had to do that in order to survive, right? Because if they're in trauma and they're a little kid and they're believing that their dad is a monster and abusive and horrible, they're not going to be able to survive and continue to kind of go through life growing up. So they've had to kind of, in their mind, like learn how to split people and split things kind of as all bad and all good. And so in this counseling with them, right, we are as image bearers. We really desire to embody Christ so that they can learn how to learn who trust, what trust looks like. How do you trust God with fake people? Like, right, if you're going to say you're going to be there on time, then be there on time, right? You want to have some predictability for them because they're used to life being super volatile. And so you want to establish some patterns for them, some healthy rhythms for them. You want to point them to Christ, right, that he knows, and he's walked this road of betrayal. Like, I usually have clients going through just the Gospels and spending time looking at the crucifixion and his betrayal and how he was described. And knowing, too, that he understands these things, because, you know, if you're looking at Mark 3:21, like, his family was saying, hey, he's out of his mind. He's crazy, right? When they heard of the ministry he was doing in the town, they sent people to go get him. And so that's typically what would happen in their family. Right, their family, if they tried to tell or be honest, or maybe they were acting out in all these different ways, they were marked as bad or the crazy one, or worse, they were really excelling in all these areas and hiding, and nobody knew what was going on. That one actually is sometimes a little bit more difficult. And then having them know that there are other people who have suffered just as they have, go have them look through the story of Joseph and really going through it slowly, right? Because we tend to read that. We're like, oh, yay, hooray. Like, he was, you know, second in command. And you're like, oh, it's 15 years. And we know that it affected him because you look at what he named his sons. Right? He who takes away my affliction, he who takes away from my pain in my father's house. Right? I mean, these are the names of his sons. And so we know that it was painful. So many women in our church who've experienced childhood abuse, we have a group for them in recovery, and it's just an abuse group. And so it's helpful for them, like 1 Peter 5, to know that there are other people who have suffered just as they have throughout the world. And so getting them to see, hey, you're not the only one, right? There's other people who can really identify with your experience. And this is helpful for the relationships, for them to be able to relate, right? And we'll kind of talk about this a little bit later. Education, like, is really helpful to go, hey, yeah, those responses that you're doing, super common. I'm not saying that some of those things may not be simple, but they're very common. And so one of the things, too, is there's a story in Judges, if you guys have read it, it's about the woman who was sent out, the concubine, by her husband, and who was raped repetitively by these men. It sounds like a horrible story to have them read. But I do, in the order to see that, hey, he was a really bad shadow of a good husband, right? So a good husband, who was Jesus, laid down his wife. Right, he was the one who was broken, right, for us, right? And so getting them kind of to see that hey, there's this part of your heart, like, this is wrong, this is horrible, what this husband did to this woman, and that is what, hey, Jesus didn't do this, like, he specifically laid down his life and died for us, and this is just a way that our heart's seeing, hey, this is wrong, and the Lord is going to set this right. And so we want to think that we need to be slow to speak, always with them. And so it is important, and I have women who I call are a little bit more difficult or needy, and I usually have a group of women walk with them at our church, and I say walk with, like, minister to them, because there may be, like, some real difficulties going on. And so I'll get a group of, like, our mature women, and I'm like, hey, me too. You're going to pray with her. You guys are going to become friends, and they're great. And so it's this kind of ministry that's organic that goes on, that she has more people than just me. And it does take time, right? It takes time for her to trust me at first, and then it'll take time for her to trust them, right? But then what we want to do is, like, we want to increase her community and her support. And so those people are pointing her to the Lord and listening to her and mourning with her. Really fast. The fourth thing is that
we're still waiting on the pieces.
Okay. So this fourth thing is this difficulty regulating emotions and impulse control. And so people that struggle with prolonged trauma, they overreact to stress. Right, so they don't know how to calm themselves, they're easily overwhelmed, and they have extreme reactions to things. So something that might be a 3 gets a 9 response. They overreact to minor stressors. There's not a lot of emotional width there. And so they have a hard time sustaining this positive emotional state. They have a hard time expressing anger. And this is usually what you'll see it coming out like in addiction. Maybe they're using drugs. There's a lot of pornography in men. Maybe there's eating disorders, compulsive sexual activity. There's self-harm, suicidal ideation. Now, I will say this. Not everyone who is cutting has an experience of trauma. So please don't hear me say that. And not everybody who is addicted to drugs, right, has an experience of trauma. But they're typically using things to cope, right? And so they're using it to try to manage their pain. And so often if you do something destructive, it's really to get peace and quiet, right? It's a calmness. It's an escape. And so it also can be a reactment of their earlier abuse if they're self-harming, if they're cutting themselves. And it's kind of this internalization of lies. And maybe it's an attempt to try to, like, break through from their disassociation. And so ultimately they're doing so because they want to kind of reduce this, like, negative feeling that they have, this horrible feeling. And so something that's kind of interesting is that when you bleed, when you cut yourself or when you just bleed, that endogenous opioids are released. Just kind of the way the Lord created our bodies, right? So that we can do something and take care of ourselves and move into action. But when you're cutting intentionally, right, you get kind of high on that. And it feels good. And so that's why not only is it emotionally feeling good, but it's physically feeling good to them. And so Romeo Dallaire was, he was a general that was stationed at UNAMIR, which was in Rwanda. And so he was stationed there, left there in the Rwandan genocide in 1994. He actually had orders to return home, but he said he was going to stay to be witness to the atrocities that were occurring. So the UN is peacekeepers. They can't actually do anything, and they can't use weapons, right? So he was there for several months. Now, he has been outspoken on his PTSD that he experienced and that has happened there. And he's written several books. It's a really fascinating movie. It's called Shake Hands with the Devil. And it's about his time in Rwanda. And so he said, and he's talking about this, and he said, the moral injury was really starting to rip me apart. How do I decide between who lives and who dies? How many times can you take that decision? So Romeo would be given legal orders to pull out of Rwanda, knowing that he was trying to protect them, and those that he was trying to protect would be killed when the troops withdrew. So for months in Rwanda, he witnessed brutalities of war, rape, massacres. When Dallaire returned to Canada, he turned to self-destructive behavior in an effort to cope with the trauma. He says, what you really seek is a way to attenuate the pain. You can either drink yourself to death, or you can go to drugs. You can go to destroying your own life in any other type of fashion. And so Romeo recalled one moment of self-harm that stood out to him above all. He was at home drinking scotch, and he leaned against a sofa. He said, I remember that I had my father's old shave razor, and I felt that maybe physical pain would ease the mental pain that was ripping my guts apart. That's when he started to realize the depths of his struggle with PTSD. There was a release in self-harm that was there that I had never felt before, and that was one of the lowest points of my self-destruction, that I actually felt guilt and shame, finding solace in destructing myself. So I thought that was helpful for just us to read, to know, like, this is a man who is super educated, has since become a believer, but was really really grasping with the reality of what he was witnessing and experiencing. And so with a counter with this, we want to look at each response separately, and this is an important part of stabilization. You don't really want to start processing trauma, right? Not only if they're in an abusive event, but if they have an ongoing eating disorder or if they're cutting. Now, when you start to talk about the trauma in more depth and detail, some of these things flare up, and so you have to go back to, like, making sure that it's what I call safety and stabilization, that they're secure. And so you kind of go back and forth. But we want to make sure that these self-destructive behaviors are replaced, right? And so part of, like, if you're thinking about self-harm, right, it's them trying to take the punishment in on themselves and looking at what Christ has done. And so a lot of times it's really difficult for them to identify emotions, especially if their abuse happened as a small child. And so their way of trying to understand this is they can't process physically. And so what's helpful is I usually have them write, like, mood logs down, like, reflect back on the day to see, you know, if you felt a certain way, ask the Lord to reveal if you felt angry or fearful or sad and what was in your body, or knowing, like, right before you wanted to cut, like, what were you thinking about? How were you feeling? If you did cut, right, what desire was met, right? So when you were cutting, what were you hoping to achieve? So we want to look at, like, kind of the desires of the heart, right? And ultimately it's comfort that I found is when they're trying to self-harm, they want comfort. And so one of the things we really want them to do is mature in Christ, like, not to be led by their emotions, but by their faith. Now, this aspect of complex trauma is where I've seen a lot of counselors do harm and ministers do harm, right? They're really frustrated. Like, why aren't you walking in maturity? Why are you still doing this? Why are you still acting out, right? I mean, this is something that they've done probably for a really long time. And it just takes time to learn things that are new. And it really takes time to put off these sinful things. things. And they're really hurting. And so we want to balance well the sin, but also looking at the suffering. And I think Jesus always did this, obviously, perfectly. And his response to women who were broken, if you look at the Gospels and the woman at the well, right? I mean, he confronted her suffering, also pointed out her sin, but he does this in such a beautiful way. And so we really want to look back and think about that. And so that's one of the things just to caution to keep up as a red flag, is this is the part where people get really frustrated, whether it's small group leaders or whatever. It's like, oh, they're such drama queens. They're so hysterical. I can't believe they're doing this again. Like, and there's a reason why. And that's, you know, we want to be firm, but they, at the same time, we want to really, really be loving. And so in this, I also introduced them how to write psalms. Like, we look at the Psalms of Lament. We look at imprecatory psalms. The psalms are great at learning how and what we do with our emotions and how to process our feelings. The next thing in complex trauma, Curtis talked a bit about this a little bit, is dissociation, which is this alterations in consciousness. And so Viktor Frankl was a Jewish psychiatrist, and he was in the concentration camps. And he's actually one who said an abnormal reaction to an abnormal situation is normal behavior, right? So we think about people who dissociate, and we're like, that's so weird. But if you think about it, everybody has a little bit of dissociation. You probably don't always remember how you got home, right? When you're driving in your car, and we're like, oh, I was thinking about something else. Right? And so there's a way in which it was helpful for them, right? If you think about a child who is being sexually abused by her father, she can't actually process this in real time and be thinking about it. So what she does is she goes up in her mind, right, to a little corner in the roof, and then she plays pretend. And she thinks about all these different things, because imagine little children being abused, especially when they're so great at pretend play, right? And so this is a way in which the Lord is helping them and protecting them to be able to be in the situation. Or if you look at first responders and veterans, right, there's ways in which they have to kind of split off their consciousness, right? And so the total experience may be too overwhelming. So there's elements of the experience that have to be kind of split off from this narrative that they're telling. So typically there's sensory issues that are split off in nature. So there's certain smells or sounds, right, that they're not, they don't have this whole picture. And so that's why there's certain smells and sounds and things they see that, like, trigger or bring these things back, because these are the things that may have been dissociated because they weren't really, like, fully in the picture at the time. And so because they've had to learn how to separate these experiences from everyday life. And so often, too, right, they dissociate their bodily sensations and experience the body. Anytime they're feeling anger and distress, it's kind of like they cut themselves off from that. And so they even may not know what it feels like on an extreme level to be in their own bodies. And this is called depersonalization. So where it's kind of like they're on the outside looking in, and they still kind of detach themselves. And so they usually have the ability, if they've been chronically abused, to intermittently access information. So when you're sitting with someone, they're not going to come out and tell you, let me tell you all the ways in which I've been abused. And this is when I was four, and this happened, and this happened. And now, if they've had a lot of counseling and prayer and time with the Lord, they can, like somebody on the other side of recovery. But if you're getting someone and they're struggling and they have an addiction and maybe you hear there's a little abuse, they're kind of going to be repetitive. Yeah, my dad was mean to me. Yeah, and they might tell one story over and over. Or, oh, this time, yeah, he locked me out of the house and made me eat my food in a dog bowl. That was actually what happened to the client of mine that I told you about. Their story comes out in little bits and fragments. And so a lot of times they're super forgetful, even in adult life. Now, that doesn't mean if you're forgetful. My friend always says, hey, make sure you say that. That means that you've experienced trauma. Because it's pretty common in complex trauma. They often space out regularly or kind of retreat within themselves, like shut down when they get confronted or there's any painful emotion that reminds them of trauma. And so they really can't tell this cohesive story. It just comes out in fragments. They often talk kind of like small children and just kind of shut down when they start to talk about it. If we want to think about it, like this happens, it can often happen so much so where it becomes kind of more of an identity. But really, we're not thinking about multiple personalities. I don't know if you guys have seen Sybil. It's an old movie. It was a woman who had been chronically abused, had lots of trauma, and she had all these personalities. We're not talking about that. It's called dissociative identity disorder. We're just talking about when they kind of leave time. They may rage and do all these things, and they don't actually have a memory of that. I think that's the pizza. I have like two more things. We're good. Okay. And so what we really want to do in counseling is really teaching them to live in the reality in which God dwells. That's a great sign of mental health, right? Is really living in that reality in which the Lord dwells. We want to be able to kind of attach them to their five senses. So some of the time, like when I'm counseling them, if we're going through trauma, I'll ask them, hey, what do you think of this poster over here? Now, I'm a big essential oils person. I don't think they do anything. I just think they smell good. My sister's a big believer in, it helps back pain and stomach pain. And I'm like, hey, it smells good. I usually have some of those and I'll have them smell things. Want them to, like, as they're talking, to kind of get aware of the senses that the Lord has given them. And a lot of times I'll have them journal. Like, hey, is there any time that you lost time today or that you spaced out or anything you don't remember? What was going on before that? Anything that kind of triggers like a dissociative awareness. And then a lot of times this is when I'll talk with roommates or I'll talk with husbands. Like if you see them kind of blank stare, kind of just daydream or, it may not be anything really weird. It's just maybe that they're losing time, right? Now it could be that they pass out, black out, don't remember anything. So it is important to kind of be aware of this and be aware when they're in there. And then actually when you're telling, the story to you, it is important to remember, hey, this is, you are here, you're with me, hopefully they're in a safe place, you've gotten them out of, if they're in a domestic violence situation, reminding them, like, the Lord sees them, the Lord has them, and just bringing them back to the present. Next to last thing that they experience is, it's called somatization, which is just these bodily experiences that they have. And so Curtis talked a lot about this, about the brain, and that chronic trauma impacts us physiologically. It changes the brain. And so it's not just this terrifying event, it's a terrifying life. And so when you're living in constant distress, it has a profound impact on your adrenals. And so they don't regain emotional equilibrium. So this is kind of like when I'm telling you, when people get really frustrated, when these people can't control their emotions, we do have to remember that the body and the brain kind of all go together. And so when there's a chronic exposure to stress, it compromises our stress response and the capacity to evaluate stimuli and to even to encode. It's part of called the Broca area, which is encoding verbal memory, and it hinders processing. One of my best friends, she fosters her and her husband, and they were fostering a little girl who had been extremely abused by her biological mom and her mom's boyfriend. And she was language delayed by 2 years. And because her trauma had just processed her ability to talk. And so she's made leaps and bounds, but she's had to do lots of different, play therapy and different things to learn how to talk. They have an overreactive nervous system. A lot of times this happens, I'll see this with women, where, man, they've got IBS or Hashimoto's or chronic fatigue, chronic pain. There's kind of all these different things. Bessel van der Kolk, he's a psychiatrist, and he is talking about how there's this underproduction of serotonin. I'll kind of skip this over, but he just talks about the difficulties that are going to affect sleeping, and they're going to be really oversensitive and hyperarousal. And so with kids, this might present as stomach aches, bedwetting, nightmares, headaches, UTIs. Now, again, this doesn't mean that if your child has a UTI that they've been sexually abused. So please, that's not what it means. It usually happens chronically, though, if they're experiencing abuse. And so Bessel van der Kolk did state that having lost the ability to put to words their traumatic experience, physical symptoms may provide some chronically traumatized individual with a symbolic way of communicating their emotional pain. And so I think that's important. And we see that in Scripture. We look at David even talking about his own sin in Psalm 32. When I kept silent, my bones wasted away through my groaning all day long. And so we see these physical symptoms that are coming out in his body when he's not confessing sin. So it's the same, right, when we're being sinned against and you're not using your voice to talk about these things. And so one of the ways that I really teach women, like, how do you take care of your body? I'm always like, hey, have you gone to the doctor? When's the last time you went to the doctor? doctor, because it's important, and taking care of our bodies are important, taking care of our teeth is important. We would know that, but it's very different when you've chronically been neglected and taught to neglect your body. And so really teaching them how to steward their body for the kingdom of God. And this is a lot of times where I've seen women overeat or undereat. And so teaching them kind of at times working on a meal plan, just different things. And looking at the fact that we do live in a fallen world. And this is really true that sin does affect our bodies and vice versa. And so... finally, kind of the last thing that's a marker here is this distorted perception, this change in meaning and purpose of life. And so Viktor Frankl, who I quoted earlier, the psychiatrist who's in a concentration camp, said that those who have a why to live can bear almost any how. And so with that, you know, knowing that when you've experienced complex trauma, it's really hard to make sense of life. Maybe there's not a purpose. They're super fatalistic. And this is kind of where, you know, God may be confusing at best and evil at worst. Right? It can result in despair, loss of belief. We kind of talked about this. Is he in control? All these conflicts that kind of happen. And so this is where we look at, you know, purpose and meaning. We start going back to the gospel, looking at Isaiah 61 and applying the gospel. And this is really where the narrative of the gospel fits into their story, right? Reteaching them on, hey, actually, this is like Hebrews 11. You are the faith hall of fame. These people that were going through these experiences, again, we read them and we're like, oh, yeah. But, I mean, think about what it was like to be them. Right? Think about what it was like to be Jeremiah, who was fallen into, right? He was just faithful to the Lord. Even at times he told the Lord, you deceived me, right? I mean, that he even had the audacity to say that to the Lord, but the fact he did say it, and that we are given the freedom to continue to wrestle with God and to be able to bring our doubts and our fears to him. And so teaching them that, and then teaching that, hey, their story isn't ultimately, and we'll talk about this as I wrap up, about them. It's about a bigger story. And so life really does have to go on. And so these are kind of the stages in treating trauma. And the first one, there's three, safety and stabilization. The second is trauma processing and grieving. And the third is reorganization and connecting. And so the three things we want to focus on are relationship, voice, and power. And so safety and stabilization is probably the most critical part of the recovery. Right? This is when they're learning to trust the Lord. This is when they're learning what are safe relationships, who they are, who are others, who is God. It's not linear. They're probably going to go like this through the stages, right? And so you're embodying Christ. And so you start to move towards memory, but you want to think about, you want to teach them basic skills, right, on stewarding the body, about the character and nature of God, images of who they are in Christ. And Franklin Roosevelt, he would say courage is not the absence of fear, but rather the assessment that something else is more important than fear. And so there was an example of somebody who was just like physically feeling all of the fear, but trusting the Lord in the midst of it. And I was like, and they were super confused because they were like, no, I'm sinning. And I'm like, no, you're just feeling fear. I was like, you're actually trusting and praying and moving towards the Lord. This is what faith is. This is good. And so you have to kind of discern and start to question what their belief of faith is and God and what that looks like. They might have some real legalistic issues of this is what it looks like to be a mature Christian. And I'm like, actually, mature Christians are knowing that they need God more and having to be even more dependent upon them and knowing how weak they are. And it's what Curtis was saying. Hey, you have the opportunity to know that you are so outside of control. It was interesting. Even the Lord points, there is a, there was a Muslim psychiatrist, and he was in a Bosnian concentration camp in the war, and he had quoted this, and I wanted to share it real quick. Even with non-believers, some of the things that they say, and he had said, Juka, who was a guard who was abusing him, he said he did not appear in the morning, which meant that he must have been caught in the middle of a battle. Basilica was safe for another day, but he was struck again by the randomness of it all. Any illusion he ever had about being in control of even the smallest things were gone. The only thing he could control now was his own response, and he was determined not to become like the guards that he despised. So I think, I mean, the Lord's gracious even to show, I mean, he's a Muslim non-believer, hey, you're outside of nothing, you control nothing, right, and to see, like, who is in control. And these are the things, right, where we want to talk about safety, trust, we want to look at relationships and community, some of these things, taking responsibility, knowing that you can't do everything for them. And these are where places where I'll get them to just meditate on a few verses, too, when we're looking at Jesus, right, you look at the idea of Jesus in the Gospels, right? And we don't do through big sweeps. We might do one verse at a time, just looking at, you know, John 19:23, right? So they took his clothes, right? And seeing how they can identify with him in that. Or Matthew 26:36-43, when it's talking about, hey, Jesus was in the garden, and he's praying, he's asking his friends, hey, keep watch, right? They keep falling asleep. One girl said this was so helpful to her because her mom was always asleep when this abuse was going on. And she had such anger at her mom for constantly falling asleep, like being asleep when this was happening next door. And I was like, hey, he knows. And that's what she was telling me. She was like, he knows what it's like. He knows what it feels like to be betrayed by somebody that you love, and they wouldn't stay awake. And so this is an important part for them, for that relationship to be reconnected with the Lord first and foremost, primarily, and then with you. And so we really want to make sure that this is where they feel safe and secure is with God. And so kind of bringing them out of isolation and showing them how to be vulnerable. This takes the most time. And again, it's not linear. It just takes a lot of time. And then the second thing is trauma detailed processing and grieving. And so this is being able to retain their voice and speaking the unspeakable. And so sitting with a woman who's been abused, again, it's going to go really slow. They're going to talk really slowly. You want the memories of their abuse to evolve from, you don't want this to be the focal point of their life anymore, right? Towards the end of processing and grieving. That's kind of the goal, right? To where, hey, this is an event, but this is not the cross, right? This event does not define me anymore, right? This event, this is not who I am. This is what happened, and this is how the Lord redeemed, right? And so looking at Joseph, right, you know, Genesis 50:19-21, he's saying, hey, this was evil, like the evil that you meant, like God used this for good, for the salvation of many people. And so getting them through the trauma processing, again, this takes a lot of time. You kind of go back from processing trauma to safety and stabilization, to processing trauma to safety and stabilization. And so with that, getting them to see kind of moving in to what does forgiveness look like after they've been processing this, right? So we want to look at what we've been forgiven of. And Miroslav Volf, he says, to remember a wrongdoing is to struggle against it. And so they've tried to live by suppressing it or denying it. In all these different ways, right? So they have been struggling against it. We want to teach them how to do it rightly, to go, hey, we don't want this to define your life anymore, right? It held you captive. The Lord is here to set you free. And so he also says that through the memory of the passion of God, he can purify our memories of wrong suffered, because our identity stems neither from the wrongdoing that was done to us when we were required the perpetual accusation of the wrongdoer, nor does my identity stem from my own false innocence, which would lead to like this illegitimate self-justification. One of the things, and this is a hard thing, but so important, it's kind of towards like another part of processing, is to get them to see their abuser not as sin, but as a sinner. And as all sinners, right, the Lord, right, will bring justice either in an attorney apart from him if they do not turn and repent, or on the cross, right? And that, hey, this cross is sufficient for your sins and for theirs. And that the seeds of sin, right, lay within all of us. Because ultimately an abuser and oppressor, it's the seed of control, right, which is what they have attempted to do by responding to their suffering. And it's also the seed, right, of power, control, and just to see that those things, and pride, ultimately a heart of pride. And so there are differences, but for the grace of God, right, any of us, right, could be that. And so really getting them to see this, and so really getting them to talk. I have them journal. I have people that I just sat in silence with, and they can't speak these things. It takes weeks. Sometimes they bring in pictures, like from the internet, and I'm like, hey, just tell me what it was like living like as a kid when we're processing memories, and they can't actually speak words. They'll give me pictures. We'll journal. We'll look at, I use the Jesus Storybook Bible a lot. We'll bring in some things like that. Have them look at Psalms 22. And then the last final thing is that reorganization, this reconnection. And so the best recovery, Judith Carman is talking about this, are in individuals who have a survivor mission. And so what that means is basically we process through a lot of the trauma. They feel safe and stable. They're not acting out in self-harm. Maybe they've got a good home group around them. And so now you're going to looking at, okay, hey, we're moving past this as a defining event in your life to how are you going to use this? Because the Lord takes us to places where we would not want to go in order to produce enough that which we couldn't do on our own. So what are we going to do? Like, you know, so there's several women in our church. There's one woman who has a safe home for women. There's another woman who's leading an organic group. And so we want them to use this in the mission of God, because that's a part of the gospel, right? That he's redeeming them in order that they can be sent out on mission. And again, all of this is toward the end. And that's kind of that impact or power that they have on the kingdom, like how... he gives us instructions to subdue, to rule, and to image him by caring and creating, and so to not shut down. And so all of these things take time. I know I'm at the end, and we really want them to see that who they are and their life is not defined by this anymore. It was defined by trauma, but not their trauma, the trauma of Christ. And so that he's leading them into suffering, like into the suffering of Jesus. And so they're going to be able to understand this more than others. So I know that's a lot. Sorry, I went really fast. I could probably talk on this for another 3 hours. But...
Rachel, thank you so much. All the efforts that goes into this.